It's Thursday, April the 15th, and you're listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism here at the Hoover Institution. While I'm the only fellow to have that title, I'm not the only podcaster at Hoover. There's Econ Talk with Russ Roberts, the Grumpy Economist with John Cochran, the Pacific Century with Misha Oslin and John Yu, the Libertarian with Richard Epstein, Law Talk with Richard Epstein and John Yu, and Goodfellows with Neil Ferguson, H.R. McMaster, and John Cochran, and yours truly. I moderate that show every week. If you want to subscribe, very simple. Go to hoover.org, which is our website. Click on the Publications tab, then click on the tab for Podcasts. You can subscribe to any or all of them. You can also sign up for our monthly Pod Blast, which delivers the best of our podcast to you each month. Hoover Podcast, just one facet of ideas defining a free society. My guests for today's podcast, plural, are David Brady and Doug Rivers. Dave Brady is the Davies Family Senior Fellow here at the Hoover Institution and the Bowen H. and Janice Arthur McCoy Professor of Political Science at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Doug Rivers, likewise, is a Hoover Institution Senior Fellow and a Stanford University political scientist. He's also pollster extraordinaire, chief scientist at YouGov PLC, the global polling firm. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bill.
So when we did this in 2020, we called it the state of the race because there was a race going on. I don't know what we call it now, but I do have a question for you, Doug, as we start this out. I've been reading a book on the 1920s, political leaders of the time. First chapter was Woodrow Wilson. Second chapter is Warren Harding, and it talks about his campaign in 1920 and the slogan, Return to Normalcy. Doug, as you look at polling data 5 months after the presidential election, 3 months now into the Biden presidency, do things look normal to you?
Well, first, Bill, I'm offended you directed that question to me since Brady is remembers Woodrow Wilson well. So there clearly have been a few changes. Donald Trump not being in the news, that he's been starved of oxygen. And Joe Biden, some weeks being relatively invisible, has led to, a longer news cycle where things don't boil up at the same frequency. We're seeing that Biden is north of 50% in approval. Historically, that would not be great by presidential standards, but he's as high as Barack Obama was, higher than Donald Trump was, higher than George Bush, except in the aftermath of 9/11. I think there are some signs that we can point to that it appears to be normalizing, but then there are lots of signs that things are pretty much as they were. Contrary to some polls, which show a decline in support for Republicans, our polling seems to indicate that's relatively stable, no big change. The people who thought that Republicans would reject Trump after January 6th, that hasn't happened. The support for Republicans, approval of Republicans that supported Trump and so forth, really haven't taken a big hit following the January 6th riots at the Capitol. So I think it's a glass, half full or half empty, depending on how you look at it.
Okay, so Dave Brady, number one, do you want to respond to Doug's cheap shot about you being a Wilson or Evans man in 1916?
I can understand that because when you asked who would win the 2020 election, there's only one of us that actually said an English sentence that said Joe Biden would win. So, yeah, I understand it.
Yeah, 1916 was Wilson versus Charles Evans Hughes, or as they called him, Charles Evasive Hughes, because he just could not be pinned down on things. But Dave, when I talk about normalcy, I'm looking at polls such as Monmouth's, which shows Democrats approve Biden 95%, Republicans give Biden an 11% approval rating. Gallup, 96% Democrats approving of Biden to only 10% of Republicans. Back to the Monmouth poll, Dave, independents favor Biden 47% to 43%. Then getting back into Gallup, Dave, 64% of college graduates approve of Biden's job to only 51% of non-graduates, 49% of men approve, 62% of women approve of Biden. This sounds like role reversal. You take the numbers for a Trump and flip them, and you've got Biden numbers.
I think that's exactly right. There are a few more Democrats, and the Democrats approve of him. So he's been running a little over 51, 52%, which Donald Trump was never able to do. So it is the reciprocal. So I agree. That's all that's happened is the Democrats, a few more Democrats. And I think Biden, by staying out of the news, as Doug said earlier, I think that he's got that little bit of a majority approval. And that is exactly what you said.
Yeah, you know, one thing, Doug, is I was going through YouGov numbers in preparation for this, and I looked at Biden's approval rating on YouGov. You have him at 51% as of April the 10th. That'll be updated by the time some people hear this. That is a remarkably flat, and by flat, I mean calm seas, Doug. He has never been over 55%. He's never been under 49.6%. His likability number per YouGov, Doug, on election day, right after election day, I should say, 43%. It's now 48%. And if you look across the ideological span, liberal, moderate, conservative, they're all very consistent. So if the goal here for Biden is to be, well, sort of like a golfer who's playing for par in every hole, so far, so good, no?
Yeah, I think that's the situation. There hasn't been a massive change in the numbers. The right track numbers have improved a little bit. They were at about 30% at the end of last year, and they're in the high 30s now, so about a 5-point pickup on that, with people thinking things are going in the right direction, though those are not stellar numbers by any standard. But it is surprising, at least our measurement of Biden's approval is not, 60, 70%. It's a little over half. There are other polls that show Biden in the mid to high 50s, but I don't think they're adjusting correctly for what we learned in 2020 election.
Yeah. So this strikes me as a very effective strategy, because this is a White House that wants to, well, downplay this president. He will address Congress on April the 28th, which is on the eve of his 100th day in office. Otherwise, he is, in terms of primetime appearances, he did have a press conference that was during the daytime. He did have a very brief message to the American people on the 1-year anniversary of COVID. But unlike the past president and the president before that, this is a president who's not in the news every day, not trying to drive the news, and there's no cult of personality behind him. So again, it's I just wonder if this is sort of the calm after the storm.
Well, interesting to me is that with George W. Bush, we had the first of our presidents who can't be unifiers. So the question is, people say they want to unify the country, but the best measure we have of that unification is if you look at what percent of the Democrats approve of Biden, and then if that's 90% and say 10% of, only 10% of Republicans do, then that's 80, and that's a pretty high score. Presidents starting with George W. Bush have been not been unifiers. And in spite of the fact of what you just said about Biden not being out front, not being in the news all the time, I just don't see in the short run what's going to change those numbers. Democrats like him, Republicans don't. And independents are mixed. They're, last time I looked in the YouGov poll, they were slightly less than approving of him, but about half approved, half didn't.
Right. So I guess what we'll
change. Bill, I think the public has sort of given up on unification. Only 26% of the people in our latest poll said they thought Biden will be able to bring the country together. If you take an item like, do you consider Joe Biden honest and trustworthy? He's running at about 45 honest and trustworthy and 41 not. Without having done much that I could see would be a reason for people to distrust them that much. That's just the world we live in, which is a fair fraction of the country is going to be opposed to the president because they're of the opposite party. And that's not going to change.
Right. So this gets to the question of what he should be doing in the 2 years that he has Congress, and what is the question of overreach. This has been the bane of the last two Democratic presidents. Barack Obama came to office in 2009. He lost 63 House seats in the 2010 midterm election. If not for bad Republican candidates in Missouri, Delaware, Nevada, and Indiana, he would have lost the Senate as well. Bill Clinton lost both chambers in 1994 under the perception they overreached and went after the issue of health care. Hey, Prady, I want to read to you an excerpt from a column that ran in The Hill the other day by a fellow named Dave Spencer, who's the founder of a group called Practically Political, which is a forum for pragmatic nonpartisan solutions. He advertises the headline, How Democrats Can Defy the Odds in 2022. Here's the premise, Dave. You go back the past 100 years or so in presidencies, FDR gained 9 seats in both the Senate and the House in 1934. Reward for the New Deal. 2002, the aftermath of 9/11, Republicans picked up 8 House seats and flipped the Senate. So the question is, can Biden do this again? And here's what Mr. Spencer writes, Dave. Quote, if Joe Biden continues to get high marks for his handling of the COVID-19 crisis, the American Rescue Plan Act remains popular, and the economy gradually improves, he'll be viewed in the same heroic light as FDR and George W. Bush. Second, be it former Presidents Bill Clinton in 1994, Barack Obama in 2010, Republicans were able to effectively run against a president's persona more than his policies. This won't be true with Biden, a non-divisive figure who has been known for decades. You have written, Dave, you and your colleague Brett Parker have written about 2022 and how things could go wrong for Democrats. Tell us a bit about your data.
So, the first one was a piece that we did after the 1994 election that Doug Rivers wrote with us. And in 2010, we analyzed the same thing, which was essentially who paid the price for, I think in both cases, the data is pretty clear. The price was paid. The issue was healthcare, and the price was paid by moderate Democrats. Democrats came from districts that were not overwhelmingly Democratic, but were moderate, and they were moderates, and they were forced to vote on things. So in the 94 piece, if you Democrats who lost, the more often they voted with Clinton, the more likely that also, and the more moderate the district, the higher the percent of loss. Very liberal districts, you can vote with the president, it doesn't hurt. In the 2010 election, in the House seats that were lost, our analysis it cost, if you voted for the healthcare bill and you voted for cap and trade, that cost the Democrats 43 seats. And in short, my view is Bernie Sanders is dead wrong. Bernie Sanders said in 1994 and 2010, what hurt the Democrats was they didn't go far enough left. My view is in 94 and 2010, they went too far left in both cases and paid the price. So the question today is, has Biden gone that far left? And I'll just say this and get what Doug says. Thus far, the $1.9 trillion stimulus package, if you look at that, Republicans say they're opposed to it, but on every one of the big tickets, $1,400 checks, the $300, there's a majority of Republicans in favor of all of those items, save the item about increasing employment in state and local governments. So I don't think the stimulus bill has hurt Biden at all. The question then is there in the infrastructure bill, et cetera, that would drive it left so that moderate and independent, moderate and conservative voters. So let me just say one last thing. In 2010, there were 52% of people who were Democrats said they were moderate to conservative, mainly moderate. Of those, 21% voted for a Republican candidate. Mm-hmm. Of the 42% of Democrats who said they were liberal or very liberal, only 2% voted for a Republican candidate. So for me, the key is what is happening with moderate and moderate to conservative voters in the Democratic Party. And the last point I would make is today in 2021, there are fewer of them. They still over 40%, but there are more liberals and very liberals in the Democratic Party now than there were in 2010.
Right. Doug?
Yeah, so I agree with Dave that the COVID relief bill was widely popular, and the infrastructure bill so far is polling pretty well. It's probably a little large, and it wouldn't hurt Biden if they compromise on it a bit. So far Biden has pursued stuff that is widely popular. There's been zero Republican support, which I think is potentially a problem for Republicans, that just being the party you know is works when the stuff is unpopular, but it doesn't work in this context. There is a small warning signal for Biden. So we ask every week people to say whether they think Joe Biden is conservative, moderate, liberal, very liberal. And the very liberal number has ticked up a few points since January, and the moderate number has ticked down a couple points. It's not a big move, but if Biden pursues stuff that does get perceived as too left-wing, Democrats can lose their marginal voters, who are largely suburban white women, actually. Right. And that could cause problems in 2022.
I want to add to that, I think it's very smart of Doug to have said that, because in 2010, when you started, I looked at the same thing he looked at, and over time, by the time of the 2010 election, the number of people who said that they thought Barack Obama was very liberal had doubled from what it was at the start of his presidency. So that is some indication. So that movement is something that I plan to keep tracking on the Biden presidency.
Right. And right now, if you're a Republican, you're scrambling really to figure out how to attack Biden, number one, because he is not visible every day, unlike Obama and Clinton. It's hard to make it personal against him. But secondly, going after Bill Clinton or Barack Obama on healthcare, politically very easy to do, because you're talking about the government getting involved with your relationship with your healthcare provider. And I guess, we're all Californians. Maybe the equivalent, Dave and Doug, is if somebody made a raid on Proposition 13 and came after your house taxes. So they're a very easy message to say the government's coming for your healthcare. But so far on COVID relief, on infrastructure, it's hard to attack that as government interference in your life. In other words, there just doesn't seem anything in that package so far that really would create the same sort of visceral reaction that healthcare reform would.
Yeah, so attacking deficit spending doesn't work.
In part because you've been a hypocrite for the last 4 years under Trump, if you're Republican.
Doesn't help, but even without that, it's not been effective in the last 40 years since Reagan.
Do you think, Doug, that's a function of just we're a credit and debt society?
You're trying to argue that take some short run pain, that is raise taxes, cut spending, for nebulous long-term gain. And that's usually a loser. The reason healthcare was unpopular in 2009 and 10 was the uncertainty associated with it, that there were tax increases associated with it. People were afraid of losing their health insurance. As people actually started benefiting from Obamacare, it turns out it's harder to take it away. So the real trade-off is pain now versus future gain, or the opposite. And good politics is pleasure now and defer the pain to the future.
I want to run.
Not saying that's good policy, but that is the politics of it.
I don't disagree with that, but I do think on issues like the corporate tax and the individual tax, where we have not seen, we haven't seen the full plan, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the fact that the Chamber of Commerce, Better Business Bureau, we have yet to see them start to bring the brunt of their attack against this. And I also wonder about the individual tax and what they're going to do with the dealing with the Trump tax cuts, which did bring some money to everybody, got some money. So the question is, I think for my money, where it could hurt Biden is on the tax and the tax issue. And we haven't seen that play out yet. But I agree with Doug. the proposals for the roads and the, I think the Republican criticism where they say, oh no, you shouldn't include broadband and stuff like that. That's just silly that everybody would consider that broadband. And I think it's hard to criticize bringing home care to the poor. I think you might be able to cut the amount down, but I do think the Republicans' main issue has to be taxes, and they have not been great on that for some time.
No, well, Doug, so far we've seen the Biden proposals, and those are an increase about removing about half of the Trump corporate tax cut. That polls very well.
Yeah.
And then it's tax increases on people earning over $400,000 a year, which also polls well.
Right.
Now, there's good use of polling and bad use of polling. And in this case, polls tell you what's working with the current messaging. If you have the Democrats raising corporate taxes and the economy turns, then that's very bad for Democrats, because Republicans will say, we gave you a good economy and the Democrats are taking it away. In fact, if you look across the range of issues, Democrats are rated above the Republicans by a lot on nearly every issue except for the economy. And the economy is one place where Democrats and Republicans are roughly even. And the perception of the public at large was that Trump delivered a good economy and that Republicans are relatively good at handling this. So that's another danger area for Biden.
One thing I give Democrats credit for so far is message discipline, especially when it comes to taxes. You always hear the word wealthy when it comes to talking about taxes, wealthy and fair share, be it upper end earners or corporations paying their fair share. They've been just very solid on that message. You might remember Pete Buttigieg, the transportation secretary. He floats the idea of doing a mileage tax. They could not have pulled that back quicker because, again, I think they just want to stay. They want to keep this, against the wealthy.
Yes. Corporations are going to pay for it. Rich people are going to pay for it. That is a winning political message.
Okay, so I'm going to throw four issues at you right now and get your thoughts on these as potential hot buttons. Issue number one, it's one that helped get Trump elected, immigration. Issue number two is the broad topic of culture. This is just the idea of, for example, boys playing girls sports, girls playing boys sports, just the idea that you're changing the America we once knew. Issue number three, gentlemen, would be guns, because there will be some run at gun control, I suspect. And then the fourth one, let's begin with it, is the Supreme Court. Earlier today, the Democrats in Congress rolled out a bill that would add four justices, making the court a 13-justice composition. I did a little sleuthing on this. The CNN exit poll in 2016 found that one in five voters said the Supreme Court was one reason they'd cast a ballot. Of the voters who said it was the most important factor, 56% of them voted for Trump. According to the Washington Post, 26% of all Trump voters said the Supreme Court was the basis for the decision. It sounds like a way to maybe motivate Republicans in 2022 if there is some sort of run. It's worth noting, by the way, that Biden has not endorsed this concept. He wants a commission to look into it. So he's playing for time. But guys, do you think the Supreme Court has potency as a midterm election issue?
I think people overrate it. The first thing is any kind of procedural issue is hard to make a popular issue. So there are not people out there saying, what I need to fix my problems tomorrow is more people on the Supreme Court. It does appeal to the Democratic activist groups because, they realize with six conservatives on the court, they're not going to get anything out of the Supreme Court, and they may lose a lot of things out of them. But it's interesting. If you look at the court is, while it's perceived as being now a moderately conservative institution, Republicans and Democrats don't differ a lot in their ratings of the court. It's not that Democrats at the moment view the court as their biggest problem. So I think Biden would be well advised to stay away from that at the moment. Now, if the Supreme Court comes out and it does some things like it overturns Roe or it issues some gun control rulings that are really unpopular, that might be the time to take this up.
Dave, I'm shocked that Doug didn't take a cheap shot at you for asking where you were in the 1938 election. But if you go,
but I agree. I actually, but I agree that I was still a gleam in my father's eye. It was a it doesn't poll well. Doug had a question in one of his polls. Only 29% of Americans, two polls I saw, around 29-30%, said it was a good idea to expand the court. So I agree with Doug. It's not at this point a good idea. If they do some things that turn out not to be good, then you might have the switch in time that saves nine, which is Bill's reference to 1938 when Roosevelt said he was going to pack the court and didn't. Yeah.
And if you look at the 1938 experience, first of all, the Roosevelt plan was just too cute by half. It wanted to add justices after they turned the age of 70, not just adding just fours as Bill does. And it was the wrong idea at the wrong time for Roosevelt. First of all, he complained about judges blocking his agenda. So he sounded like a man who wanted one man rule, which probably in 1938 with fascism on the march was not a good thing to do. Second, there was a recession in 1938. Unemployment spiked backed up to 20%. I dug up a Gallup poll from August of 1938, shows 66% of the public wanted FDR to pursue a more conservative course at the time. And then finally, if you look at the results from that midterm after the Republicans had had drubbings in 32, 34, and 36, the turnout in the 38 election was 48.6% Democrat, 47% Republican. So they were motivated, I guess, in part by this. But Doug, it sounds like not just running the Supreme Court is issue, but you have to have just sort of a compendium of things hitting at the same time.
Agreed.
Yeah, I mean, we are, right now things are going relatively well for Biden. So I think people are overrating the midterm loss pattern. There was a period of 40 years where the incumbent president always lost in seats in Congress in the midterm election. That was in a different world that wasn't as polarized on partisanship as the current one is. I think a much bigger problem for Democrats in the midterm is going to be the fact that Republican states and particularly places where Republicans control the government are going to gain congressional seats through reapportionment.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, if you look at the numbers, by the way, right now, if the House currently sits at 218 to 212, there are five vacancies, four of which are Democratic seats. So let's assume Democrats peak at 222 or 223. So that means that they lose six seats, they're out. The Senate's 50-50. I did a little digging through the 2022 races. When you look at competitive Senate races, and by that I judge that by 5% or less the last time there was a vote in that state, a Senate vote in that state. The Democrats would have to defend the following states you might consider as vulnerable: Nevada, Georgia, Arizona, and New Hampshire. And if you go by this 5% rule for Republicans, you'd have to play defense in Missouri, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, North Carolina. And I'll throw one more into the batch, even though it's not a 5%er, and that's Ohio with Rob Portman stepping down. He won his last race by 20%, but that state seems wide open right now. And there, Doug, you see Republicans beginning to, have to form the circular firing squad because they're J.D. Vance, a hillbilly elegy author, wants to run. There are two or three Trump candidates who want to run. So you could have just a really bloody primary and produce a bad candidate, as was the experience in 2010.
Yeah, so Ohio is definitely an interesting one because Democrats have a formula for how you can win Ohio. It's called Sherrod Brown.
Right.
So even though Ohio has been bad for Democrats in presidential elections the last few cycles, it is one they could win the Senate. Pennsylvania, they won the presidential election. That's mm-hmm. where Pat Toomey is retiring. That's very winnable for Democrats.
Right.
North Carolina is ones where Democrats have come up short, as they have recently in Florida, but both Florida and North Carolina are winnable. Georgia is going to be a tough one to defend, but will be close in 2022. Arizona, I tend to think that you got to favor the Democrats in that race.
Mark Kelly, yeah.
Yeah. So, the map's reasonably good for Democrats in 2022. The the states they have to defend are winnable, and there are some obvious potential pickups. But it's not going to be easy if it's a Republican year.
Right. And how would you gauge the House, Doug?
As I said, the House is harder in some ways because the reapportionment in 2022 does favor Republicans enough to make it roughly even. The House candidates, it's harder for them to distinguish themselves from their party. A lot of the Democrats that picked up in 2018, particularly in places like California, lost those seats in 2020. Mm-hmm. In 2020, and there are, a handful of vulnerable incumbents on the Democratic side this time around, and not a lot of great Republican targets for Democrats to pick up.
No, Dave, I could see a Republican candidate in Texas, let's say, pulling a thread out of the infrastructure bill or the COVID bill and saying that, Congressman X voted for $690 million to go to San Francisco or something like that. Maybe that's effective in local politics, but maybe we're too far out to be talking about this. But based on, what's happened so far, it's kind of hard to look at this and kind of foresee how the Republican wave forms, a wave formed in part by just one kind of large theme to run on, like in 1994.
Yeah, they or in 2010. So I do think it's going to be more individual races, but they do have some advantages. Since 1994, the Democrats have really only held the House for five times, and Republican. If you look at go across the congressional districts, Trump won a majority of the districts. Didn't mean that. The Democrat didn't mean that some didn't elect a Democrat, but on average, given the fact that Democrats are packed into urban areas and you have a large number of majority minority districts, it does give the Democrats, the Republicans rather, some advantages. That plus the reapportionment, as Doug talked about, will make the House, I think, exceedingly close. But at this point, I think you're right, Bill. I don't see what the national issue would be that drove as it drove the votes in 94 and 2010. I don't see it.
Yeah. I thought Biden won about 230 CDs.
It's very close. I thought it was Trump, but it's close. That may be correct. I don't think we have the final count in all of them, but. Romney in 2012, Romney did win a majority and so on. But at any rate, it's very close.
Yeah. The problem was that Republicans, down ballot ran ahead of Trump. And if it hadn't been for the Georgia runoff, it would have been a disaster for Democrats losing, not picking up the Senate, which they were counting on doing. Mm-hmm. I overconfidently predicted would happen. We thought they would pick up 5 to 10 seats in the House, and they in fact lost
11.
That much. I think the big story from last year was that unlike cases where a previous president lost, you think of Jimmy Carter or George H.W. Bush or Gerald Ford, those presidents pretty much disappeared. And I think, other than Ford, they lost by pretty reasonable amounts. And the fact that the presidential race was close and the party, Republicans did better in Congress than they were expected to, gave Trump some legs that previous losing presidents didn't have or didn't want.
Which is strange, because it seems to me that the most reasonable interpretation of the election was that it was a referendum on Trump.
Yep.
And the referendum was no on Trump, and down ballot, it didn't go against the Republicans down ballot. And had Trump not done what he did in Georgia, the Senate would be the Senate would be Republican. But the key for the Republican Party is exactly what Doug said. What happens with Trump? He is already, say, in the state of Georgia, interviewing people who want to run against the governor, who want to run against the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And if he goes on a personal vendetta like that, and you have a lot of nasty primaries, I don't see that as a good thing for the Republicans' chances in 2022. We're going to have to, and we do have a Hoover project that both Bill and Doug are on that is trying to deal with what is the future of the party system, with emphasis on what's the future of the Republican Party, and a lot of it hangs on what happens with Donald Trump, what he does, and how Republicans perceive him.
You see Trump in very subtle ways influencing Republican politics. For example, Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, played golf with him the other day. Maybe it's like playing golf with Trump, but I imagine he just wants to stay on Trump's good side, because why? If Trump doesn't run in 2024, he can offer an endorsement to someone. I suspect DeSantis would like to be first in line for that. I'm in South Carolina right now, where, you know, Nikki Haley, the former governor, is, you know, suspected to be a 2024 candidate, but she said the other day that if Trump is running, she won't run. Why would she say that? I suspect she's just probably just giving him a wide berth and being as deferential as she can, in part because maybe she'd like the endorsement as well. And then, Doug, when we're going through the Senate races, you mentioned North Carolina. Laura Trump, his daughter-in-law, talked openly about running as a Republican candidate there. So now you'd have the name Trump on the ballot.
I think there are a lot of Democrats willing to contribute to Laura Trump running.
Exactly. But he's not going away. And getting back to that book, I mean, about the 1920s, you know, Theodore Roosevelt plays into a factor here, because he runs in 1912, divides the Republican Party. Then in 1919, he is making noise about running for president in 1920, but he passes away early in 1919, not a factor. But Dave, there's your example of a former president who did not leave the stage.
Well, you also should note that there was a poll in the Hill that had some really high number of people who Republicans who'd leave to go with Trump if he started a third party. So Doug re-asked the question, if Trump had a third party, would you vote for him? Would you stick with the Republicans, or would you think about it? And that broke it down, but it still was 35% of Republicans said they would go with Trump, and 20% said they'd stay with the Republican Party, and the other 30-some percent said they'd think about it. So that's just a huge impact on a party. It is like Teddy Roosevelt. He could, if he decides to run as a third party, he makes the Democrats.
He does, but Doug, I remember when Ross Perot went down this road in 1992, then again in 96, and by 96, it became a fight between Perot and Buchanan over who was really the independent voice, and it struck me as just trying to herd kittens, trying to get an organized independent movement. Or am I missing something here? Is Trump beyond where Perot was back in the 1990s?
Well, the difference relative to Teddy Roosevelt or Ross Perot is that Trump has realized he does not need to run as a third-party candidate. The Republican establishment, such as it is powerless against him. There's a fascinating piece in the New York Times this morning by Maggie Haberman that quoted unnamed Republican leaders, presumably of the establishment wing, said they were hoping that the New York DA, Cyrus Vance, would be able to hobble Trump, because no one is able to do it. They're scared of him. The support for him is not sincere. It is sincere among the base, but among elites, I think, the perception is that Trump is is bringing them down, that he can mobilize the base, but the base is not big enough to win a presidential election.
Yeah, Dave, two issues. One is, I'm surprised Republicans have not talked at least quietly about changing some of the nominating rules, because Doug is right. If Trump ran in 2024, it's a very simple process. He just goes into every state and he wins by a plurality and just racks up delegates. And this is what he did in 2016. He doesn't crush the vote week in and week out, but he finishes first and just consistently racks up delegates. But secondly, the other factor is, if he does run, he does get the nomination, yes, you'll have an energized Trump base, but boy, just think of deflated Republicans on the other side, establishment Republicans, what Trump will call rhinos, who just don't want him back.
Well, that's why anybody who's trying to figure out what the future of the Republican Party is and where it's going has to really take into account two things. One, what will Trump do? And the second thing is that the influx of white, non-college educated Americans has meant that the Republican Party has begun to change its the policy prescriptions. It's much less free trade. It has policy proposals now from Hawley and Romney and others to provide pregnant women with cash payments until they're 18. And that is not a traditional, those are just not traditional Republican policy positions. It's a question of, as the base has changed, then politicians will begin to make policies that appeal to that base. And you're starting to see that.
Yeah, but Doug, the other curious factor about 2024, besides whether Trump runs or not, is Joe Biden's political future and whether he runs or not, because he's now 78 going on 79. He'll be 82 years old in 2024. Let's assume he's not running. So now the question, Doug, is, you know, if you're Kamala Harris, if you are another aspirational Democrat looking at making a run post-Biden, you have to be thinking about how far left your party wants to go.
Right. And, you know, Biden, I think we agree, was the only Democrat that actually could have beaten Trump, that a further left-wing Democrat would have had a really tough time. And in the end, the Democratic primaries ended up voting for Biden, not the left-wing candidates, couldn't get enough traction. But, without a Biden, I could easily see a strong left-wing candidate winning the primaries and being a weak candidate against a reasonable Republican.
Now, we are presuming in this conversation that the bulk of the American electorate is to the center, and you go too far right or too far left, you pay the price for that with that centrist electorate. And that was certainly true in 94 and 2010, and it was certainly true in 2020 for the Republicans. So the question I'd like to ask the two of you then is, are we sure that's correct now, given that if we look at the pattern of people who self-classify as very liberal and liberal and very conservative and conservative, that those numbers have increased? So the question I have to ask you is, are we sure that the center is still there in the way it has been and in the way that we've been using it for some years now? The question.
Yeah, I think it is still. I think with the rare exception, Biden, even though Biden had a very liberal platform, probably one of the most, maybe the most liberal platform of any Democratic nominee, well, except for maybe George McGovern, he still just gets by. Why? Because of perception that he's Joe Biden. He's a consensus builder. He gets along with people. He's going to put a brake on things if need be. So I think there is that, I think there is a centrist default system there. Doug?
Yeah, so our numbers are 27% of the public is liberal or very liberal. 32% is conservative, very conservative, and 30% are moderate, which suggests the description of the electorate is center right. One caveat on that is there are more people who identify as conservative than are operationally conservative on particular issues.
I mean, operationally liberal.
Yeah. So, for example, you'll find older African Americans are, say, they're more conservative, but they're very reliable Democratic voters. I don't think there's evidence that the country has become polarized ideologically more than it was in the past. The difference is it's polarized in terms of partisanship. That is, people are Democrats and Republicans. So that has the effect of very stable voting. But when a party moves too far to the left or too far to the right, it tends to lose at the polls. I'll defer to my senior colleague on this, has written one of the definitive papers on it.
I agree. I absolutely agree with that. I think it's always useful to check and make sure that you're not the only one that holds this, but I agree with what both you and Bill said. I think it's still a center right country.
Yeah, I think so too. And look, Republicans come out of last election realizing we have to do better with women. We have to do better with suburbanites. We have to do better with people with college education. That doesn't mean going further to the right. That means coming more toward the middle. Conversely, if Democrats were to lose the next election, they'd say we have to do better in flyover states. We have to be less liberal. So I don't think it makes sense for either party to go too far left. But let's wrap up the podcast, gentlemen, with this question. We're not quite 100 days into this presidency, so maybe shouldn't be looking that far down the road, but I'm going to put two labels in front of Joe Biden and tell me which one you think is probably the more realistic expectation, transformational or transitional?
Definitely transitional.
Transitional. Why so?
This is, as we started today, getting back to normalcy. That's what's popular, and that's, I think, Biden's strategy. He's doing enough to keep his left wing satisfied, but they realize they don't really have any leverage, that he's trying to go largely down the middle and do things that, even though they aren't attracting Republican votes in Congress, are attracting supports of people in the middle, independents, and actually some Republicans as well.
Okay, Doug, Dave, excuse me. Dave.
I hope Doug's right. It's transitional. If the HR1, HR3, the proposed new bill on infrastructure, mm-hmm. and the bill on green energy after that passed, then if they all passed, I would have to say it was on the transformational side. Now, my personal view is, I think those will be modified in the Congress, and we'll see where that goes. So I would could be transitional, but if every one of those things passed, all those bills, then it would be transformational.
Yeah. So I got my COVID shot the other day here in South Carolina. One of the reasons why I'm here is because I gave up on getting in California in 82 time, but it could have been simpler in South Carolina. I did get the Johnson & Johnson jab. So the good news is I haven't stroked out on this podcast yet. Last time I checked, I'm not a woman between 1849, and I'm not on birth control, so I may be okay here for the time being. But as we look at this presidency, guys, is Joe Biden still sort of been given, I hate to say gift, but is he still sort of taking advantage of the fact that COVID overshadows everything? It overshadows the campaign, it changes the primaries, it allows him to stay inside and not wage a more vigorous campaign. But I'm just wondering, fellas, in terms of what he is doing out of the White House every day, COVID dominates the news. When shots are halted, people can't get vaccines, I'm not sure they're paying attention to the intricacies of an infrastructure bill.
I agree. So that is what makes it, that's what he's doing, very smart. Because if he can get the vaccine gets out, it gets out in the way it can by sort of midsummer, and most people are vaccinated, then as all the economic forecasts show, you're looking at a 6-7% growth, and then he's going into 2022 in really good shape. So I think he's doing the smart thing by focusing on COVID, focusing on the vaccination. And the first bill, very popular. So and the idea is he wants there to be huge growth. And so, yeah, I think it's smart politics up to this point.
Yeah, he was elected to manage COVID competently. And so far, I think he's passed on that dimension. The one that's coming after it is, can he restore the economy to what it was pre-COVID? That's a tougher one. But you know, right now, I think people are relatively optimistic about the economy, and if it gets back to where it was pre-COVID, he can say that he's delivered on the two most important things.
Yeah, but Doug, I'm curious, in California, for example, where the governor has promised to reopen things by June 15th, maybe that doesn't happen if the vaccine supply line keeps getting fouled up. I just wonder if voters, Doug, would blame just sort of under the radar Joe Biden for this, or if they'd lay it at the feet of Gavin Newsom.
Well, I don't think the Democrats are too concerned about losing California. Gavin Newsom is a bit concerned, but
But no, in terms of where voters will turn their frustration over you know ongoing you know COVID situations, if there's talk of reopening, and it begins to get pulled back.
I think the thing we learned is that voters were amazingly tolerant of bad things happening. They did not blame the bad economy that followed the pandemic on Trump, where we had a historic increase in unemployment. They did not seem to blame Trump that much for 500,000 deaths. Where Trump failed badly was in being the responsible adult in the room, I think that's what hurt him on COVID. But
so Dave Brady, final thought here, maybe the Biden presidency is bad news for people like me who grew up being wanting to be White House speechwriters and delve in communications, because if I'm his chief speechwriter, I've had a pretty slow job here for the first 90 days in office. If I'm his communications people, the president, put a lid on the president every day and so forth. So maybe to quote your good friend, Jerry Brown, maybe there's something to be said about less is more.
That's a good place to end. I know it'd be a little slow. It'd be a little slow as a speechwriter. I agree.
And Doug, any thoughts?
I wouldn't want to be Biden's speechwriter.
Yeah. I mean, we've gone through this really interesting transition where we go from Obama, who's just about giving speeches and just being in front of the mic, and we go to Trump, who is his own press secretary and has to be in the news cycle every friggin' day, to Joe Biden, who's happy to be out of the news cycle. So maybe there's something kind of, maybe it's the pause button that people are enjoying right now.
We'll see how it wears over time, but I think the short run is you can see a bit of relief of people not having to keep up with what's going on.
Okay, and I guess I'll be curious to see what kind of bump he gets when he does give his speech on the 28th, his first address to Congress, the first time he's done something as president in prime time.
I predict zero.
Okay, and we will leave it there. Dave Brady, Doug Rivers, thank you for a very fun conversation. You've been listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please subscribe to our show. If you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's spelled @HooverInst. Dave Brady is not on social media, but Doug Rivers is. His Twitter handle is @Doug_Rivers. That's DOUG_RIVERS. And his excellent polling company, YouGov, is on Twitter. Its Twitter handle is @YouGov, and that is spelled YOUGOV. I mentioned our website at the beginning of the broadcast, www.hoover.org. You can also go there and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Dave Brady, Doug Rivers, and their Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Matters of Policy and Politics. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.